I have other friends who will help me.
Who? Ms. Tipton?
That's a pretty good start. Those are solid people, Claire. They don't have any political agenda. They're reliable and do exactly what they say they'll do. They don't have bosses and they don't judge. They're not afraid. But I have some other ideas, too. I spent years tearing the government's criminal cases apart. I can figure out how to build one. She paused for a few seconds. I heard her sigh. What? I said.
I'm just afraid you're going to find yourself beating your head against the wall if you try to go after them the traditional way, she said.
Why? What makes you say that?
It's been going on for a long time. Something just isn't right. Believe me when I tell you, Darren, I've been around these walls for a long time, and something stinks here. You're not going to get to these guys using informants and wiretaps?
So what then? I said. Should I just start killing people?
I don't know. Maybe.
I paused for a long minute before responding. This woman was different from Grace, far different. She changed the subject by saying,
Are you ready for tomorrow?
Her grandfather, Senator Roger Tate, was flying into Knoxville to make a personal appearance with me at the Knoxville Civic Auditorium. Will anyone be there besides us? I said.
I've told you, Darren, it will be packed. People will come from hundreds of miles around just to see my grandfather, to shake his hand, to hear him speak. He's brought billions of dollars into this state through the Appropriations Committee. People genuinely like him, or at least most of them do, and they'll want to make a connection. They won't care much about you at first, no offense, but when Senator Roger Tate tells them he's flown all the way from Washington because he has such strong feelings about you and what a good job you'll do as District Attorney General, people will pay attention. The story about Morris's wife slapping the teacher in the face is going to hit the streets in the morning, and then we'll have the rally tomorrow night. We'll cruise from here, and then you'll be in a position to deal with Morris and the sheriff and a fine brewer.
Claire had been pretty much spot on with everything she told me up to that point, so I decided to trust her. How about dinner tonight? I said. We can talk about tomorrow and plot against Morris and the sheriff.
Where?
My place. I'm a good cook.
I don't know if that's such a good idea,
Claire said. Come on, I'm not going to hit on you. We're doing this very unusual thing together. You've been a huge help to me, and I'd like to cook dinner for you. I don't see why we can't at least be friends. She paused for several seconds.
What are you going to cook? I'm a vegan.
I thought I detected a hint of pain in her voice, as though I'd perhaps hurt her feelings when I said I wasn't going to hit on her. Figures, I said. What would you like?
I don't know. Maybe some kind of roasted Brussels sprout skewer with a dipping sauce?
Brussels sprouts. There wasn't a dipping sauce in the world that would make Brussels sprouts appealing to me. My stomach turned at the thought. Sounds great, I said. What time?
7:30.
Wine?
I'll bring the wine, Claire said.
Perfect. See you tonight. Chapter 23. Claire showed up right on time, looking chic in designer jeans and boots and a peach silk blouse. The more I was around her, the more I noticed how striking she was. She turned the heads of both men and women everywhere we went, and she carried herself with an air of confidence that was just shy of haughty. She had a beautiful smile, though, which I was seeing more and more of, and she was relaxing around me more often. We joked with each other, made wise cracks. I liked her sense of humor. I'd found a recipe for roasted Brussels sprouts with a lemon-thyme dipping sauce, and had done a test run before she came to the apartment. The texture seemed fine, but to me the taste was disgusting. But one of the first things she said when she walked in the door was,
"Something smells divine."
"Really?" I said. "You think that's divine?"
"You don't like Brussels sprouts?" she said.
"I'd rather eat canned cat food."
"Well, I hope you're not going to. It won't go very well with the wine I brought."
I'd made some chicken marsala for myself, and since she was a vegan, I'd mixed some prosciutto in with it just to taunt her. It turned out really well, and I was hungry. I gave her a corkscrew, she opened the wine while I plated the food, and then we sat down to eat.
"You haven't told me much about Grace," she said about a minute into the meal.
The sound of Grace's name surprised me, and I stopped chewing for a second.
"I'm sorry," Claire said. "If it's too painful, just forget I mentioned it."
No, no, it isn't that. I just hadn't heard anyone say her name in a while. When she first died, I thought I'd die too. But something unusual happened. She came to me in a dream. It was like it was real. And she told me she was disappointed in me. She basically said goodbye. She slipped through this veil of mist, and I haven't dreamed of her since. I don't feel her presence. I don't feel as though she's watching over me. I feel guilty about it, but to be honest, I've thought very little about her. I can barely remember her voice. I have some photos, but I put them away. I just don't want to look at her every day and revisit all of it. And if she's abandoned or given up on me, which I think she has, then there isn't much point in torturing myself.
Why would you think those things? Claire said. Why would you think she's abandoned you or given up on you?
She was a gentle soul who wouldn't harm anyone. She was truly a wonderful human being. She was as smart as they come, she was kind and considerate, and she was even-tempered. She loved her work. She loved people. She hated injustice. She was as close to perfect as anyone I've ever met.
That's a tough legacy to follow, Claire said.
Grace defended criminals and never once gave any thought to the crimes they'd committed. I used to be able to do that, but I changed. She didn't.
And you think she abandoned you when Dr. Futura disappeared? Claire said.
I didn't say that.
It doesn't matter. You don't have to. For what it's worth, I think differently than she did. If you did something to Futura, I wouldn't condemn you for it. Just like I wouldn't condemn you if you did something about what happened to your mother, or if you even the scales with Ben Clancy.
You're hard-hearted, I said.
Violent crimes are basically acts of terrorism, she said. I've been taught, and I choose to accept the philosophy, that there is only one way to fight terrorism, and that is with violence.
I smiled at her, and although I agreed and could have continued talking about violence, I tried to change, or at least soften, the subject. It's different with my mother, I said. I can remember her voice, but her face has faded some from my memory. When her house was blown up, they used so much dynamite that it practically vaporized everything. There wasn't a single photo of her that survived the explosion and the fire, and since I was living there at the time, all my photos burned up too.
Again, Claire said, an act of terrorism. Did Grace love you? I mean, toward the end.
You don't beat around the bush, do you?
Is there any point? Answer the question, please.
I shrugged my shoulders. Grace loved me very much at one time, I said. After my mother's death, I became difficult and I tested her limits. We were back on the mend when she died, so I suppose the answer would be yes. I think she loved me toward the end.
And you loved her?
I did. We would have married not long after the baby was born, I feel pretty certain about that. It's like you said the other day, I've been through some difficult times. I can become moody and distant, but she was patient with me. She was good to me. When I think about her, I miss her very much. When I think about what we might have been if some of these things hadn't happened, it saddens me. I felt a tear slide down my cheek and wiped it away with my napkin.
I'm sorry, Darren. Claire said.
It's all right. Really. I'm not ashamed to show emotion when I talk about Grace. I feel cheated that we didn't get to raise Jasmine together. I think we would have done very well raising a child.
I'm sure you would have.
So, what about you? How about a little quid pro quo? I don't know anything about your personal life. You told me you don't like men. I think you said they were boorish and boring. But I find that hard to believe.
Why do you find that hard to believe?
She took a sip of wine, and I noticed the pale red imprint of her lips left on the glass by her lipstick. Because of the way you carry yourself, because of the way you dress, you want men to be attracted to you. Do you do it so you can swat them away like flies?
I have to admit you surprise me quite often, Claire said. You're far more perceptive than you want people to believe.
So you don't hate men?
No, I don't hate men. I find them deliciously attractive, if you want the honest truth.
That's one of the reasons I love to see a woman drink wine, I said. Half a glass down the hatch and the truth starts bubbling up. Are you attracted to any particular type of man or just men in general?
I like macho guys, she said. I like men who do things, who live for something. They have to be intelligent, of course, and I mean extremely intelligent, but they can't sit on their asses. They have to be physically fit, maybe a little bit dangerous, and they have to believe in a cause or an ideal and live to promote that cause or ideal. And I'm not talking about just any cause. It has to be something I consider noble.
I would never have taken you for a Guinevere. You're a hopeless romantic in search of a king or a prince. She winked at me.
Maybe.
Ever dated a soldier? One of those officer and gentleman types?
I did,
she said. She didn't seem to want to discuss it. Come on now, Claire, you can't just leave me hanging. I opened up to you, it's your turn. I was getting to know her better, but she was still a mystery to me. I wanted to know what made her tick, how she felt about certain things. I wanted to know what kind of man she was interested in, because, whether I wanted to admit it or not, I was becoming interested in her.
He worked at the Pentagon when I met him, Claire said. He was a major in the army, a Green Beret who wanted to move on to Delta. He was a good man, very dedicated to his work.
Did you love him?
I did, and he loved me. But he loved his work more, so I suppose the old adage that one must be careful what one wishes for is true. I found and fell in love with a man dedicated to protecting and serving the country he loved, but there wasn't enough room in his life for his career and for me. He ultimately chose the career.
How long since the breakup?
Last year in November.
Ah, so it's still pretty fresh. I reached across the table and patted her hand. I won't say it gets better with time, but it changes. The pain eases just a fraction each day that goes by. You learn to cope. And who knows? Maybe you'll find another night one day.
Maybe, she said. I don't think I'll ever find anyone like him, but I guess there's always a chance.
And in the meantime, you get to work with new and exciting people like me, I said. She smiled and pointed her fork at me.
You are not boring, she said. I'll give you that. The way you went off on Henshaw and Kurtz this afternoon was a complete surprise.
That was for you, I said. The first words out of his mouth were, I didn't vote for your father. What an asinine thing to say. I knew right then it wasn't going to go well. Besides, I don't have much use for the feds. They framed me and put me in jail. They dieseled me. They tried to break me, turn me into a robot.
They dieseled you? What does that mean?
They handcuffed me with the black box cuffs that they can practically break your wrists with. They shackled me, and they put me on a bus. I stayed on the bus anywhere from 16 to 20 hours a day for 3 months straight. They'd feed me once a day, a bologna sandwich, a piece of fruit, and some milk. And they just rode me from prison to prison. There was no bathroom on the bus, so I had to be careful about what I ate and drank. If I lost control of my bladder or bowels on the bus, I was going to take a bad beating. Took a shower maybe once a month, didn't shave or cut my hair. They call it diesel therapy. It was torture. They do it to people they deem disciplinary problems.
Who does it? Claire said.
The U.S. Marshals, U.S. attorneys, or prison wardens usually pick out the people who get dieseled, but the Marshals do the dirty work.
That's unconscionable. I'm going to tell my grandfather about it.
He knows, I said. There have been congressional hearings where it's come up. They turn their backs to it so they aren't accused of meddling in how the federal criminal justice system operates. Nobody wants to appear soft on crime.
How did you get through it? Claire said. I mean, mentally.
About halfway through, I just made up my mind they weren't going to break me. And I thought a lot about Grace. She was my lawyer then, but I was already in love with her.
Amazing, she said.
I raised my glass, and she clinked hers against it. To never getting dieseled again, I said.
To becoming the next district attorney of Knox County, she said.
Excellent, I said. Now tell me everything that's going to happen tomorrow.
Chapter 24. The event, which was held at the Knoxville Civic Auditorium, was billed as a political rally and had been well publicized. I had to hand it to Claire. She really knew her stuff when it came to running political campaigns. I had a huge organization of volunteers, envelope stuffers, sign distributors, and people who would make cold calls on my behalf. There were billboards all over Knoxville. I'd seen my name on at least 10 buses and 6 billboards. Darren Street for District Attorney General, a man of integrity, the slogans beneath my face said. I found it horrifyingly embarrassing at first, but after seeing the images over and over, I got used to it. I didn't believe it, but I got used to it. Had it said, Darren Street for District Attorney General, a dangerous man of occasional integrity, I would have liked it better. The rally was held in late October, just 2 weeks before the election. Claire, as always, was right. The auditorium held 2,500 people, and it was packed. They weren't there to see me. They were there to see and hear a man who was an icon in Tennessee, Senator Roger Tate. Several dignitaries came, state representatives and senators, the lieutenant governor, and the speaker of the Tennessee House of Representatives. They all sat up on the stage with us. About 5 minutes before the proceedings were to begin, the sheriff made his entrance, dressed in his uniform and his cowboy hat and carrying his signature Colt Python revolvers. He took a seat on the second row on the stage, right next to the county clerk. I sat next to Senator Tate. It was a surreal scene and a surreal feeling, thinking I was about to be endorsed for a local political office by one of the most powerful men in the United States. The thought actually ran through my mind. My God, my mother would be so proud. The mayor of Knoxville opened the rally by welcoming everyone and introducing a pastor who said a few words and then led everyone in the Lord's Prayer. A beautiful young child, a girl perhaps 8 or 9 years old with long blonde curls and wearing a pale blue dress, sang a rendition of the Star-Spangled Banner that gave me goosebumps and had everyone in the place on their feet yelling when she was finished. The lieutenant governor introduced Senator Tate, and Tate gave a 40-minute mini State of the Union address, combined with a State of the State of Tennessee address. He spent the last 5 minutes talking about me and what a fine gentleman I was, how I had seen hard times and overcome them, and how I would make a fine district attorney by protecting the people of Knox County and ferreting out corruption and aggressively prosecuting criminals. And then it was my turn to speak. I was spiffed up to the max. Claire had bought me a charcoal gray tailored suit with a shirt and tie and socks and shoes to match, and she'd ordered me to go to a spa in Knoxville that morning that she said was the best in town. They were waiting for me, and they pampered me for 2 hours, including giving me a haircut and a shave. Prior to the rally, there was another barber waiting backstage who put hot towels over my face, gave me a close shave, and made me smell the way I would imagine a high-dollar corporate CEO would smell. There was a teleprompter in front of me, and I stuck to the words Claire had written. I thanked everyone for coming. I said I was honored and humbled to be endorsed by a man as revered as Senator Tate, and that I would bring honesty, integrity, and organization to the district attorney's office. I didn't say I'd bring those things back to the office, because it had been occupied by Ben Clancy for so long before Morris was elected that there hadn't been honor or integrity in the district attorney's office for a long, long time. I kept it short, around 8 minutes, and then I began to thank everyone again. Just as I was about to finish, a man holding up a large placard came walking down the aisle against the wall to my right. The placard said, "Where is Dr. Nicholas Fratura?" "Did you kill my brother?" the man yelled. "What did you do to him?" I didn't know whether the man was really Fratura's brother or a Morris plant. Maybe he was both. Security started to move toward him and people started booing. I raised my hand to quiet the crowd as the man reached the bottom of the steps. He was about 30 feet away. "What's your name?" I said. "Michael Fratura." "And Dr. Nicholas Fratura is your brother?" "Was my brother until you killed him." "Who told you that, Mr. Fratura?" I said. "Stephen Morris told me you killed my brother." "Did he offer you any proof?" "He said Nick didn't save your girlfriend and your baby, that you lost them both because of a rare medical condition, and that you tried to get Mr. Morris to arrest my brother." "That's true, Mr. Fratura. I went to Stephen Morris and asked him to arrest your brother for reckless homicide. He was on call the night my girlfriend and baby died, and he was too drunk to care for them. He could have saved them, but he arrived late and he was drunk. By the time another doctor got there, it was too late. They were gone." "And Mr. Morris wouldn't arrest him, so you killed him. What did you do with his body?" If something has happened to your brother, Mr. Futura, I'm sorry for your loss, just as I'm sure you're sorry for the loss of my girlfriend and daughter. But I didn't harm your brother. If he's gone, I had nothing to do with it. Liar! You're a liar and a murderer! I hope you rot in hell, you miserable son of a bitch! At that point, a security guard took Mr. Futura by the arm and led him out the door. I noticed Claire, flanked by two Knoxville police officers, follow them out. I'm sorry, I said to the audience. I've been falsely accused before. There isn't really anything I can do other than deny the accusations because they aren't true. I hope you believe me. Thank you again, and I wish all of you the best, no matter who wins this election. Roger Tate got up and spoke for another 10 minutes, controlling any damage that might have just occurred. As he was finishing up, I saw Claire motion to him from the corner of the stage. He said, "Excuse me for just a second," and walked over to her. She whispered in his ear briefly, and he returned to the microphone. "Ladies and gentlemen, the man who just claimed to be Dr. Nicholas Futura's brother is really a gentleman named Ronald Blair. After he left the arena, the Knoxville police officer asked him to provide some identification. After a couple of minutes of questioning, he admitted that he was paid $1,000 to put on the show we all just witnessed. We've decided not to press charges." I breathed a deep sigh of relief as people yelled their disapproval. Then I started to wonder about the $1,000. He said he'd been paid $1,000, but he didn't say who paid it. Between the release of the information about Morris's wife, the revelation about the plant at the rally, and the endorsement of Roger Tate, Morris was as good as dead in the water. My money was on Claire. I was betting she'd paid the guy. And it had worked perfectly. Damn, she was good. Chapter 25. Sheriff Corker was nervous. He and Harley Shaker had been summoned to the small trailer where Roby Penn lived on a Tuesday evening. Cigarette smoke hung heavy in the kitchen. The three men were sitting at the table drinking beer and playing Texas Hold'em. Sheriff Corker had shown up at the allotted time. Harley had shown up 10 minutes late, which caused Roby to go off on a 5-minute profanity-laced rant about respect and wasting other people's time. Roby had even threatened to shoot him. The sheriff had finally calmed Roby down. They'd settled in and were about 5 hands into the game, but the sheriff knew this evening wasn't about playing cards and strengthening male bonds. Something was troubling Roby. He was fidgety and even more irritable than usual. "We got something we gotta do," Roby said after he polished off his second beer and followed it with a shot of tequila.
"Yeah,"
the sheriff said, smiling. He was doing his best to keep things light.
"We need to deal some better cards my way."
"Shut up, tree," Roby snapped. "I'm serious. I've got it all planned out so you won't have to strain that pea brain of yours. Harley, you're in because you killed that Marine and put us all at risk. You gotta put in some work to make up for that."
"Work? What kind of work?" Shaker said. "I already helped you get rid of him."
"That could have blown up in our faces, but what I have in mind is going to settle things down once and for all. We need to do some wet work."
"Wet work?" the sheriff said as he sipped a beer slowly and sucked on a cigarette. "You're talking about killing people, Roby. I don't kill people. You know that."
"You don't have to kill anybody, you damned gutless little girl," Roby said. "But you're going along. I need somebody I can trust to help me and Harley get away. And you're right. Some people need to get dead."
The sheriff looked over at Shaker, who was staring down at his cards.
"I got no dog in this fight," Harley said. "Y'all got your scams going over here. All I do is fight once in a while."
"But you killed that Brewer kid. Brought a lot of pressure down on Tree and a lot of pressure on me. I figure you owe us."
"I don't figure the same," Harley said.
The sheriff could feel the tension building in the air. It was dangerous to stand up to Roby, and Harley was making him angry.
"Tell you what," Roby said. "Either you do what I want you to do, or I'm gonna come to your house in the dark of night, and I'm gonna slit your throat. I'm gonna slit your wife's throat, and I'm gonna kill all three of your children. Then I'm gonna go over to your mama and daddy's and kill them. I'll finish up with your brother, your sister, and their families. Hell, I'll wipe out the whole damn Shaker line. Do you have any doubt I'll do what I say?"
Harley was obviously shaken by the threat. As he lifted his cigarette to his lips, the sheriff noticed his hand was trembling. Roby noticed, too.
You better be scared, because I ain't fucking around here. Stephen Morris is going to get beat in this election. He's already told Tree he might go to the feds and cop to some kind of deal to save his own ass. If he does, we're finished, and I don't intend to allow that to happen. He's gotta go, and so does his wife, and both of you are going to help me.
Why do you want to harm his wife, Roby? Tree said. She ain't involved in all of this.
Don't be a damned fool. You think she hasn't asked him where all this extra money has been coming from? You think he hasn't told her? And do you think for a second that she's going to want to give up the fine lifestyle they enjoy now? She'll be right by his side when he goes to the feds.
But she doesn't know anything other than what he's told her.
Exactly, Roby said. My guess is he's told her everything. She's dead, Tree. She may be breathing right this minute, but she's dead. I've made up my mind.
I think it's a mistake. It's overkill. It's bad enough that you're thinking about killing a sitting district attorney.
Who's about to get his ass whipped in an election?
Doesn't matter. You're gonna murder a sitting district attorney and his wife? What about his kids, Roby? You gonna kill them too?
If I have to. And his fucking cat or dog or whatever. Anything that gets in the way gets killed.
I'm not gonna be a part of killing kids, the sheriff said. If you're planning to kill his kids, I'm out.
You ain't out, unless I say you're out.
I'm serious, Roby. No kids. You can pull that 45 years out and blow my brains out right now, but I'm not going to live with the deaths of children on my conscience. I won't do it.
The sheriff and Roby engaged in a staring match for several seconds. The sheriff could feel his heart beating hard inside his chest. He hoped Roby couldn't hear it.
Fine, Roby finally said, but the wife's gotta go. Harley, you gonna take care of her?
You're going to bring every city, state, and federal cop within 50 miles down on us, the sheriff said.
Shut up, Roby said. I ain't finished. There are two more that have to go besides Morris and his wife.
Who's that?
Morris's bagman, that asshole named Harrison, and Morris's junkie girlfriend, the one he takes drugs to so she can sell them and get high for free.
And you're planning on doing this when? Tree said.
Saturday night. I've been working on it for weeks. Got it all planned out.
Roby reached to his left and picked up a pad of paper and set it on the table in front of him.
Set the cards aside, he said. Here's the plan.
The sheriff's mind was racing as the three men huddled deep into the night. He had to prevent Roby from doing what he was planning to do, but if he did, there was a good chance his cover would be blown.
Screw the cover, he thought. It's been way too long anyway.
Chapter 26. Sheriff Corker pulled his personal vehicle, a 10-year-old red Dodge pickup, into the darkened barn next to the blue Ford Mustang. The car belonged to an FBI agent named Ron Wilcox. Wilcox had been Tree's FBI handler since the sheriff had gone to the agency looking for a way out of the jam he'd gotten himself into. Corker had approached the FBI a few months after Ben Clancy was fired and thrown in jail. He'd wanted to go to them sooner, after Clancy was beaten by Stephen Morris, but Clancy had immediately moved into the U.S. Attorney's Office and maintained his lock over the county's extortion and protection rackets. He was in that job for 2 years before the Darren Street frame job blew up in his face, and he was fired and sent to jail to await trial for conspiracy to commit murder. Clancy was out of the way after that, as far as the scams were concerned. He couldn't threaten to expose what was going on without exposing himself to a federal RICO prosecution on top of the conspiracy prosecution. But Roby immediately demanded that the sheriff talk to Morris, who had been in office for 2 years. Roby hated the government and hated prosecutors, but he hated jail more, and he wanted to ensure the protection would continue. So the sheriff approached Morris about the scheme, found Morris to be self-immersed and greedy, and it was an easy sell from there. But once Morris came on board, Sheriff Corker had had enough. He was tired of being a bagman, a go-between, and an arbiter for the corrupt players in Knox County. He'd been naive when he first took office. He knew now that he had been handpicked by Ben Clancy and Roby precisely because he was so naive, but he was ready to put a stop to the things that were going on and become a real lawman. His problem? His hands were dirty. He'd done Clancy's bidding for 2 years, and although he hadn't spent a dime of the money he'd taken, he knew he could be convicted as easily as Roby and Clancy and Morris. Sheriff Corker had no wife. He'd always been awkward around women. He was terrified of them, and no one he could trust enough to talk to about his dilemma. He was afraid to go to a lawyer because he'd always heard lawyers gossip among themselves and were notorious barhoppers. But he could no longer look at himself in the mirror. He'd gone into depressions that had caused him to consider taking his own life. But he'd picked himself up and decided to find a way out. When Ben Clancy went to jail, the sheriff had seen a glimmer of hope. He'd first arranged a meeting with Stephen Blackburn, who was still the U.S. attorney at the time, and spilled his guts. Blackburn, in turn, had put him in touch with Bradley Kurtz, the new special agent in charge of the Knoxville office. Kurtz had handed him off to the young agent Wilcox, and ever since, the sheriff had worn wires, collected names and evidence, and turned over every dime of what was supposed to be his share of the extortion money from the rackets in Knox County. The investigation had grown like a baby octopus, its tentacles stretching out with each passing month. Wilcox wanted tapes on Morris, of course, and on Harrison and Roby. Wilcox said he'd placed wiretaps on Morris's home and cell phones. Then Wilcox brought in a DEA agent named Higgins, who'd wanted the name of every drug dealer, what they were dealing, how much they were dealing, and who their suppliers were. The agent said he wanted tapes, and he wanted to develop informants. But after about 6 months, he said he'd become involved in a much larger investigation and had to back off for a while. Corker hadn't seen him since. It had been the same with the cockfighting, the dogfighting, the bare knuckle. Wilcox demanded more and more information each month. He was building a case that he said would catapult his career to the top echelon of the FBI, and he guaranteed the sheriff complete immunity from prosecution. Wilcox wanted the sex traffickers, the pimps. He wanted to know where the women came from, how much they cost, who was buying them, and where they wound up. There was no way for the sheriff to gather everything, but he'd tried to get all he could. Wilcox also wanted to know about the organizations who ran the strip clubs, where their girls came from, how they rotated girls in and out, who the major players were. It became a seemingly never-ending series of questions without answers. But nobody had ever gotten arrested, and as the sheriff walked toward the farmhouse where he met Wilcox every month, he knew that had to change, and it had to change now. It was nearly 1 a.m, and Corker was tired and irritable. Wilcox was in the kitchen, where he always was, with his feet up on the table. He was typical FBI, lean and athletic build, short hair, square jaw. Wilcox was in his early 30s, a pup compared with most of the other agents in Knoxville. He was drinking a cup of coffee. "What's the big emergency, Tree?" Wilcox said. "My wife raises hell every time I leave at this time of night." "I hate that for you," the sheriff said sarcastically. "But it's time for you to get off your ass and be a real agent. You need to do something with this case." "Watch your tone," Wilcox said. "You say you've been building this thing for years. I try to get you to move on people, and you won't do it," the sheriff said. "Well, Roby Penn is out of control. He's going to kill 4 people on Saturday night. You need to stop it." That got Wilcox's attention, and he took his feet off the table and sat up. "What the hell are you talking about?" Wilcox said. "Roby's got it in his mind that Stephen Morris is going to lose this election, which he is, and that he's going to come straight to y'all and start flapping his gums about what's been going on for years." "Why would he do that?" Wilcox said. "He'd go straight to jail." "Roby thinks the new guy, Darren Street, will crack down on everything. He thinks Morris will come to you and the U.S. attorney to try to make a deal before everything caves." "I'm not ready," Wilcox said. He looked almost frantic. "I mean, I haven't even taken anything to the grand jury. It'd be weeks, maybe months, before I could get any indictments." "After all this time? What the hell have you been doing, boy?" "Screw you," Wilcox said. "You have no idea the scale of this investigation, what's going on, what's at stake.
I know I've been feeding you good information with a spoon for years. I've been giving you tapes, names, dates, phone numbers, addresses. Whatever you've asked me for, I've tried to deliver. I've been giving you money every single month, and you haven't done a damned thing with any of it. Well, now it's time to shit or get off the pot. People's lives are at stake.
Who's he planning to kill? Wilcox said.
Morris, his wife, Jim Harrison, and Morris's girlfriend, Leslie Sabin.
Christ, Wilcox said. And he's going to do it Saturday? Do you know what he has planned?
I know everything, Corker said. He wrote it down and showed it all to Harley Shaker and me just a couple of hours ago.
Harley Shaker. That name seems familiar.
He's the guy that killed Gary Brewer, Tree said. Don't you pay any attention?
And Gary Brewer is... The sheriff sighed and shook his head. How did Wilcox ever get into the FBI? How did he manage to stay?
A soldier that went missing. Shit, Wilcox, are you going to protect these people or not? He's planning to kill Morris and his wife at Morris's house around 11 on Saturday night. He's going to call Harrison to an abandoned warehouse on Route 19 at midnight, and then he's going to break into Leslie Sabin's apartment around 3 a.m. You and a SWAT team need to be at Morris's house, waiting for them.
Them?
Shaker will be with him.
What kind of weapons will they be carrying?
Pistols.
Okay, Sheriff, Wilcox said, taking a deep breath and pushing himself back from the table.
You've done good. This is good. Just leave it to me. We'll take down Roby Penn and Harley Shaker on Saturday night. It'll be a big break in this case.
So you promise you'll be there and you'll be ready?
Damn right. They won't stand a chance. We'll ambush them.
You'll probably have to kill Roby.
We'll do what we have to do. By the way, where are you going to be while all this is going on, Sheriff?
I'll be in a speedboat in the river. I'm supposed to pick them up after they kill Morris and his wife.
Chapter 27. Stephen Morris was getting on my last nerve. He apparently liked his life of luxury and wanted to keep it, because he certainly wasn't going down quietly. Claire kept assuring me that we were leading by a large margin and were going to bury him. But he kept going on the offensive. To everyone who would listen, he was saying I was the suspected murderer. Since I was now running for public office, and since he was telling the truth when he said I was a suspected murderer, there wasn't anything I could do about it. One of the weekly newspapers ran a story and quoted Morris as saying I was suspected in 2 and perhaps up to 5 murders. That, the story said, qualified me as a suspected serial killer. And those 3 words appeared in the headline. 2 days after the reporter, whose name was John Brooks, ran his suspected serial killer story, I called the newsroom and asked to speak to him. I wanted to know why he hadn't bothered to call me and get my side of such a sensational story. I was told he no longer worked for the paper. Claire again. She didn't mess around. I continued to brush off the accusations every chance I got. Where is the evidence? I would say when asked. Show me one shred of evidence they have against me. There wasn't any, of course, and I knew it. I turned it on anyone who brought it up. He's pointing the finger at me because he never found the person who killed my mother, I would say. I was careful not to mention or criticize the police, the sheriff's department, or the TBI. After all, I would be working with those people if I was elected, even after I got rid of the sheriff. I knew it would be difficult enough, given the circumstances and all the rumors, but I was confident I could gain their trust over time. Besides, despite the fact that I was occasionally feeling some regret, I still didn't think I'd ever killed anyone who didn't absolutely deserve killing, and I would have bet that nearly every cop in Knoxville would have agreed with me. Morris's constant railing, however, was taking me to a dangerous place. It was still there, that caged lion inside of me, and Morris was beginning to represent fresh meat. Even if I was a killer, I believed myself to be more honorable than an extortionist thief who betrayed the public trust every day of his life. And as far as I was concerned, Morris was responsible for many more deaths than I was. People died every day from drug overdoses in Knox County. He protected drug dealers. People died in the sex trafficking industry all the time. He protected them. Gary Brewer was most likely dead. He protected the bare-knuckle fighting.
and that didn't even begin to take into account the countless animals that had died in the cockfighting and dogfighting rings. After watching him attack me on television one evening with a week to go before the election, I decided to pay him a visit and tell him that if he didn't shut his mouth, he'd be my next victim. I decided not to ask Claire for permission. As always, I had to be careful. I didn't want anyone else to see us together or hear anything I might say to him. I also wanted to make sure he wasn't wired. So I went into my old Darren stalk mode where I used disguises and rented cars from shady operators for cash. The next morning, I drove almost 100 miles away and bought a pair of infrared binoculars for cash from a large sporting goods store. In order to get close enough to him to have the conversation I wanted to have, I figured I would need to confine him for a little while. So I wanted to do things in such a way that nobody but Morris himself could say I ever got near him. That meant surveillance. If I did it right, even if he did go crying to the press or the cops after I had my talk with him, I'd just say he was desperate and call him a liar. I followed Morris from his home to his work and from work back home 3 days in a row, looking for an opening, and I watched his place on several occasions during those 3 days, both from the water and from a ridge I could hike to from a nearby park. On the third day I followed Morris, I learned something that Claire probably already knew. Morris had a squeeze. She was young, brunette, extremely attractive, and she came out of her apartment and planted a kiss on his lips as soon as he got out of his car. He was carrying a box about the size of a shoebox. They disappeared into her apartment, and he came back out about 45 minutes later. I didn't try to look through the windows to see what was going on. I just laughed out loud when she planted that big kiss on him. Gotcha again, I thought. I wondered when Claire was planning to release the news of his extramarital affair. I supposed she was saving it as a surprise. The bomb would most likely drop the day before the election. I did some research on the address and the apartment number Morris went into, and found out the young woman's name was Leslie Sabin. There was very little information about her on the internet, and since she looked so young, I assumed she was a student, maybe a law student he had met while doing a guest lecture. Or maybe she was an engineering student or a stripper. Who knew? Morris didn't just have a girlfriend. He also had a 6,000-square-foot mansion that sat right on the river. It was surrounded by at least 20 acres. There was a barn that housed 2 thoroughbred horses, a white rail fence that enclosed most of the property, a Lexus, a Mercedes, a BMW convertible, 2 children, and a wife. His estate was gated and named Serenity Ridge. The yard and the landscaping were immaculate. The barn looked to be nicer than most people's homes, and there seemed to be a constant influx and outgo of workers and helpers and nannies and house cleaners. Someone was always working in the yard or painting or working with the horses. The place was a buzz of activity, but Morris was rarely there. Unless his wife was independently wealthy, and I hadn't heard anything about her being so, he would have an extremely difficult time explaining how he managed to accumulate all these material goods on a district attorney's salary. I was looking forward to hauling him in front of a grand jury and asking him all about his goodies. On Saturday night, 3 days before the election, I rented a pontoon boat from the same dock where Claire had rented the boat we took Janie Schofield out on. I paid cash, wore a fake beard, and used a false ID. I took the infrared binoculars, some fishing gear, and a 6-pack of beer along with me. I eased the pontoon west until I came to Morris's estate and dropped the anchor in the middle of the river. It was early November, but the night was warm and clear, around 65 degrees with a slight breeze. Orion was directly over the boat. There were a few other vessels around me, all fancy bass boats with lots of horsepower, trolling motors, so they could get close to the riverbank and move slowly. They were illuminated by neon running lights. They stalked the shorelines in search of fish while I sat in the middle of the river and pointed the infrared binoculars at Morris's house. They'd cost me more than $500 and were surprisingly powerful. The house was within 50 feet of the water. The river wasn't particularly wide at that point, and I could see the inside of his house clearly. Morris's wife, Gwyn, was in the kitchen, chopping vegetables. I scanned the house, and movement outside caught my attention. I trained the binoculars on the movement and could clearly see Morris sitting at a high table on his patio. He appeared to be texting someone on his phone. On the table in front of him was a water pipe, and when he put the phone down, he picked up the pipe, flicked a lighter, and took a deep pull off the pipe. I didn't know what he was smoking, but I assumed it was marijuana. I smiled to myself. There he was, the district attorney general, catching a weekend buzz on a fine November night on his luxurious patio. I didn't see any sign of his kids. Maybe they were out for the evening. I watched him for a few minutes and saw him begin to fool with his phone again. Suddenly, country music filled the air. He liked it pretty loud because I could hear it clearly from where I was floating out in the river. The song that was playing was Round Here Buzz by Eric Church. Perfect, I thought. But I wished I'd bought one of the sets of binoculars I'd seen that had a video camera with audio capabilities. It would have been great to have a video of the district attorney smoking dope on his patio and listening to that particular song by Eric Church. A few seconds later, I heard a small dog begin to bark excitedly, and I saw a movement to Morris's left. A figure approached him carrying a handgun with a silencer attached to it. It was so clear through the binoculars, it was like watching a movie. And it played out as though in slow motion. Morris started to rise from the table, but the handgun belched a small amount of fire and smoke about a foot from his face, and Morris went straight over on his back. "Oh, shit," I said quietly. "Oh, shit, somebody just shot him." I watched the figure who shot Morris in the head run straight toward me. At the same time, I looked back to the kitchen to see whether Morris's wife had heard or seen anything, when another figure in dark clothing and wearing a mask walked up behind her and shot her twice in the back of the head. The second figure turned and disappeared. I trained the binoculars back to where the first person was running and noticed a large bass boat with no running lights sliding along the water from my left. It pulled up beside Morris's dock just long enough for the person who shot Morris to jump into the boat. That person was followed about 5 seconds later by another I assumed to be the one who had shot Gwyn Morris. The bass boat's engine roared to life, and they were gone. There was one other person in the boat, the driver. It had to be a man because I'd never seen a woman that large. I'd also never seen a woman who wore two pearl-handled pistols and holsters tied to her thighs. All three of them were wearing ski masks, and there wasn't a single thing about the boat I could identify, other than it was fast. It took off with a deep-throated roar and was out of sight in less than a minute. I sat there, stunned, not knowing what to do. I just witnessed the murder of the district attorney and his wife. I was almost certain the sheriff was driving the boat, both because of his size and because of the pistols, but I couldn't tell anyone. If I called 911 and reported it, even from the prepaid cell I was carrying, my voice would be on the tape, and someone would recognize it because I was certainly about to become a suspect. I sat there and looked at the patio for several more seconds. The dog continued to go crazy, and pretty soon a neighbor's porch light came on and I heard a voice call out. I pulled up the anchor and headed back toward the dock where I'd rented the boat. I knew it wouldn't be long before the place was crawling with cops. Chapter 28. I drove home quickly and sat down on the couch. I was trembling and my mind was racing. I knew I'd be at the top of the list of suspects, and I figured the cops would come knocking around 6 a.m. I turned on the television and watched it mindlessly for a couple of hours. My phone ringing brought me out of the trance. "Have you heard?" It was Claire's voice. "Heard what?" "Stephen Morris is dead." I knew it, of course, but I had to act like I didn't, so I didn't make a sound. I wanted her to think I was in shock. "Darren, are you there?"
"Yeah, yeah, I'm here. Did I just hear you say Stephen Morris is dead?"
"You did, and so is his wife."
"His wife?"
"Yes. Where were you tonight?"
"Here. I've been here going over these organizational charts and working on the acceptance speech you wrote for me. Hold on a second, Claire. Why are you asking me where I've been? How did they die?"
"The best information I have, and it comes from a solid source, is that somebody shot Morris while he was sitting outside his house on the patio. They shot his wife in the kitchen."
"So they were murdered, which means I'll be a suspect."
"That would be my guess, yes."
"Fantastic. What effect will this have on the election?"
"Unless they indict you and convict you by Tuesday, I guess you're the new district attorney general."
"I didn't want it this way."
"Neither did I. How will you handle the police when they come?"
I'll be more cordial to them than I've been in the past, but I won't tell them much.
They're going to be all over this, Darren. It's embarrassing for them.
Mortis lived in the county, didn't he? He had 25 acres out in the Tennessee River.
You're right, Claire said. The city won't even have jurisdiction. The sheriff's department will be investigating.
That's just perfect.
Why do you say that?
Because that's like the fox investigating who killed the hens. I bet my right arm the sheriff had something to do with this.
Why? Why would the sheriff want Mortis dead? Claire said. It seems to me he'd want to keep him on so they could keep their games running.
You saw the sheriff at the rally. He knew Mortis was beaten. Maybe Mortis knew it too. Maybe he threatened the sheriff somehow. Or maybe they just wanted to tie off loose ends.
Be careful, Darren. If they're capable of this, who knows? They might come after you too.
I can take care of myself. Besides, they can't just kill everybody who occupies the office. This was a warning to me, though. They want me to know they're serious. They want me to stay away.
You won't, will you?
Not a chance.
Let me know how it goes with the sheriff or his investigator or whoever he sends, Claire said.
I can't wait to hear what they have to say. Good night, Claire.
Chapter 29. Sheriff Corker banged on the front door of Special Agent in Charge Bradley Kurtz's home at 6 on Sunday morning. Corker had just gotten away from Roby and Shaker a couple of hours earlier and had gone straight to the office. It took him a little time, but he was finally able to get Kurtz's home address. He drove straight there, looking and feeling haggard and dirty. After several minutes of banging, Kurtz opened the door wearing a black terry cloth robe.
"Where the hell were you guys?" Corker demanded. "You let four people die."
"You could get shot beating on my door at this time of the morning. Don't ever do it again."
"Fuck yourself," Corker said. "I asked you a question. Where were you? Four people died. You were supposed to be there to prevent it."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Kurtz said. The look in his eyes told Corker he might very well be telling the truth.
"Where is Wilcox?" Corker said. "Get him on the phone. I met with him late Tuesday night and told him Roby Penn and another man named Harley Shaker were going to kill Stephen Mortis, his wife, Jim Harrison, and Leslie Sabin. I told him it was time to start wrapping this case up. He said the FBI would prevent the murders and start indicting people. Did you know anything about any of this?"
"Keep your voice down," Kurtz said sharply. "I got a call a few hours ago that Mortis and his wife were dead. And what did you say about Wilcox? You told him this was going to happen?"
"Tuesday. I told him Tuesday night."
"This is news to me. And what was that about wrapping up a case?" The sheriff's eyes widened. Could it be possible? No, surely not.
"The case I've been feeding Wilcox for years, the RICO case he said he was going to use to send himself right to the top of the FBI's food chain."
Kurtz opened the door and invited Corker in. "Let's go to the kitchen. I'll make some coffee. You look like you could use it. Just keep your voice down, okay? My wife went back to bed and my daughter is sleeping." Corker followed Kurtz through the house to the kitchen. "How long have you been meeting with Wilcox?" Kurtz said as he began to brew a pot of coffee.
"What? You're the one that assigned him to me."
"So you've been meeting with him ever since? Where?"
"At the safe house in Strawberry Plains. We've met once a month."
"And you've provided him with what?"
"What the hell?" the sheriff said. He felt like his head was about to explode. "What is happening here? He didn't give you anything?"
"Calm down and just answer the question. What have you provided to Agent Wilcox?"
"Anything he wanted. Tapes, mostly, and money. Video and photographs. I can't tell you how many times I put my life on the line for you guys. I did the same for that DEA guy Wilcox brought in."
"DEA? What's his name?"
"Higgins, but I haven't seen him in quite a while. He came in and acted all gung-ho, but then he said he had bigger fish to fry and he left."
"Hang on a minute," Kurtz said. He picked up his cell phone and left the room. He returned a few minutes later, scowling. "I'm afraid I have some bad news," Kurtz said. "There is no case, and Wilcox is AWOL. He's in the wind. Nobody has heard from him since Tuesday night. We talked to his wife Wednesday, and she said he went out to meet an informant and didn't come back. We thought maybe he was dead, and I just talked to the DEA. There is no Higgins around here. Never has been.
I don't understand. How can there be no case? How is any of this possible?
Wilcox came to me not long after I put the two of you together and said Morris had refused to get into the protection racket. Without the district attorney, we didn't have an official misconduct case, and we'd promised you immunity. He said he was closing it down, and I didn't have any reason to believe otherwise. He's been working bank robberies and counterterrorism. He never mentioned you.
So he just spent an hour with me once a month and collected the money? It was all a ruse? But what about Roby Penn and all the others? What about the lawyer in Nashville?
What lawyer in Nashville?
The one I take money to every month. Same cut as me and Morris. He gives it to somebody down there. I don't have any idea who it is, but I thought maybe it was the governor. He's obviously some big shot.
We'll just have to get into it, Kurt said. Like I said, Wilcox told me he was no longer running a case with you, but that's obviously changed. He's gone from a potentially missing agent to a thief and a traitor to the Bureau. We'll deal with him, and we'll check into this lawyer you're talking about.
I can't believe Wilcox took that money, the sheriff said. He took all the money I'd given him for these past 3 years and all the money that was supposed to be my share when Clancy was running things. I wouldn't spend it, so I wound up just burying it. When I came to you guys, I dug all of it up and gave it to Wilcox, too.
How much did he take, total, assuming he really did this?
Oh, he did it all right, and he let 4 people die in the process. He had upward of 6 million.
Shit, Kurt said. He could be anywhere with that kind of money.
But you'll find him.
I don't know what will happen. We'll most likely go after him with everything we have, but the Bureau doesn't like to be embarrassed. We'll do it quietly. We don't like the public thinking one of our agents could be capable of something like this.
What about whoever has taken money in Nashville? That'd be your responsibility.
That's a little above my pay grade, Kurtz said. I'll have to get back to you on that.
The sheriff slumped his shoulders and shook his head.
Man, Wilcox sure had me fooled. I'd like to snap his neck like a twig. What do you reckon he did with all that evidence I gave him?
Best guess? It's all up in smoke. I'll bet he burned every bit of it out there in back of that safe house.
I guess these murders are on me now, the sheriff said. I have to figure out a way to arrest my uncle and the man that was with him without getting myself killed.
The sheriff decided not to tell Kurtz he was the driver of the boat, but the thought of arresting Roby terrified him. And Harley wouldn't come in easy either. The Shakers and the Pens were cut of the same cloth. And it was rough.
I wish we could help you, Kurt said, but it's out of our jurisdiction.
The sheriff knew that was bullshit. Gambling was against federal law, too, as was transporting men and dogs and chickens across state lines for fights and for the purpose of gambling. But when the feds didn't feel like fooling with something, they always just said, sorry, out of our jurisdiction.
You'll at least handle your end, the sheriff said. You'll tell your superiors at the FBI what Wilcox did and start tracking him down, and you'll start looking into Nashville.
I will, Kurt said, and I'm sorry for what Wilcox did. It isn't my fault, but it also isn't typical of the FBI. I think you know that.
I'm going to go now, the sheriff said. Thanks for the coffee.
He got up and walked out of the house. The cup of coffee remained on the counter where Kurtz had set it down. It was still steaming. Corker hadn't touched it.
Chapter 30.
I didn't sleep that night. The images of the masked man walking up to Gwen Morris and shooting her at point-blank range in the back of the head kept running through my head, over and over and over. The images of Morris being shot would follow in a seemingly endless bloody loop. I was reminded once again of how fragile life is and how quickly it can be taken. I felt bad for Morris's children and wondered whether they even knew. Who would tell them? What would they say to them? I got out of bed at 5 a.m. and went for a run. My legs were heavy because of the lack of rest, and I struggled the entire way. I got back to my apartment at 6, fully expecting the sheriff to be waiting for me. But there was nobody there, and nobody came.
As the morning went on, I kept a close eye on the news reports that were updated fairly regularly on the News Sentinel's website. As it turned out, there had been 4 other murders in Knoxville that night. 2 of them appeared to be gang-related, but 2 others were not. Jim Harrison, Morris's bagman, was found dead in his car near an old warehouse just south of Knoxville. He'd been shot 2 in the head. The other was Leslie Sabin,